Hey, John, before we get started today, what would you say to doing a little announcement mastery?
A little announcement mastery? Why, that would butter my bread.
Oh, good. Yeah, because it would steam my biscuits.
Ooh.
I don't know if that's
that would fix my little red wagon.
Wait, isn't that bad?
I don't know. I mean, if my little red wagon is broken, I think someone fixing it would be pretty fucking great.
No, I know, right? But it's only ever used in a negative context. Like, ooh, I'll fix his little red wagon. No one's ever like, I think he might have a broken wagon.
Yeah. See, that it's a saying that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And speaking of things that don't make sense, I'm kidding. We're actually going to do a normal plug for a fan of the show. No reason to be antagonistic.
No reason to make fun of this guy.
Stop it. Today we're talking about Goblin Cave TV, a Twitch channel also findable on YouTube that dedicates their time to playing non-5e games live or recorded for you to watch and enjoy. And John, I don't feel like coming up with a bunch of ad copy myself, so Scheherazade this shit out for me, or I'll kill you.
Oh, no. Well, I guess I have a story for you. Do you want to see a group of people play RPGs such as, I don't know, Pathfinder or City of Mist? Or maybe like Spider-Man?
Yeah, like the 2017 or whatever, the Insomniac Spider-Man.
Well, I mean, they just really put out the new remastered Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah, they just came out with it on PC and it's all nice and pretty.
Yeah, yeah, super nice.
Yeah.
And so if you want to see people playing RPGs, a little non-5e for you, you're tired of that,
mm-hmm.
you want
Who
a little
isn't?
Something else,
yeah.
then baby Goblin Cave TV .twitch.com/banter.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I just found it by Googling it, and so can you. Goblin Cave TV.
Yeah, I mean, you might come up with their YouTube, their yeah. Twitter. Thing is, if you Google Goblin Cave TV, you'll find all of the stuff for them. You'll find all the information you need to go be like, huh, they're doing some weird circus thing. I like circus stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds like fun. So go check them out. I give you a bit.ly link, but you're not going to write any of this down. It's system mastery. No one takes notes.
No one is ever listening to a podcast and is like, fuck, where's my pen and pencil?
Yeah.
I must write down. But if I say goblincave.tv.
Or just goblincave.tv.
Or
a bunch of
just goblincave.tv.twitch.tv.
Mm-hmm. Then that's going to get in your head, and you're going to remember it for later.
Yeah, if I'm like, someone's up here gobbling my cave, you know, on the TV, now you're going to remember it. You're going to think about some goblin going up the back door while watching television, Goblin Cave TV.
You know, I can't endorse that. We're supposed to be nice to our
buyers. This is the nicest thing I could possibly do, is stick the image of an ass-eating goblin on the television, in your mind. You will never forget Goblin Cave TV. They're Goblin Cave.
Sam Sporkle, no. So anyway, check out Goblin Cave TV for non-5th edition D&D Twitch stream APs.
And this is what happens when you let us do the copy.
No, he was very gracious and said,
Goblin Analingus.
That was all on John. I didn't do that. If you're choosing to rescind your $75, just
too
take,
bad.
Take his
I
half.
Spent it already on Goblin Cave.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much. We're now going to start the regular show. We'll see you after the break.
Hello, and welcome to System Mastery, the podcast where we beat a dead horse 1d6 damage at a time. Today, we're dealing with plagues, natural disasters, roving psychos, and a psychic maelstrom that constantly presses at the outside of our perception. And the only hope is for humanity to come together in a desperate struggle for survival. So in order to distract from that, we read Apocalypse World First Edition. On today's System Mastery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to System Mastery. That's right. It's me, your host, John, and with me, not with me, but, you know, we have COVID, so over there where he lives is Jeff.
Hey, everybody.
And because of COVID and our inability to, you know, do stuff, we have special guest James.
Hello, heroes. TVs. Yeah, TVs. They might confuse me with another James that frequently appears on your programs.
My middle name is James.
These two boys having COVID. If there's a chance that one of them dies, I gotta be there for it.
Gotta be there to hear it. I need to get that death rattle.
There's a chance that you might not post that episode. So, you know, as a loyal fan.
I'm sure you're just waiting for one of us to die so you can have their seat.
Oh, yes, that's right. That's what I want. I want the job where I have to read an entire goddamn old role-playing book every 2 weeks.
You listen to the show. You clearly know I don't.
And indeed you have not.
Yeah, this time I had COVID way worse than John did. And so I have not read a page. I'm not even sure what the game we're reviewing is. I'm mostly here for color commentary.
So we read, at James' behest, mm-hmm. Apocalypse World First Edition. This is honestly one of the biggest name RPGs that we really haven't done anything with. First Ed came out in 2010, so we got another edition. It's fine that we do it on the show. Everything's okay.
It's a landmark role-playing system that has spawned hundreds of other games, so I think they probably won't take too much of a hit from this.
Have we talked about more than one other PBTA?
We've done at least one.
Yeah, that one that was like Kingdom Hearts inspired. And I can't think of another one. Yeah.
No, because we haven't actually done episodes on any of the things. Like, we've considered doing the first edition Monster Hearts and a whole bunch of other stuff. We've, of course, done one shot of Masks. So
it's true.
Yeah.
All right, We're getting some early PBTA, but we haven't really reviewed a lot of the games. And, you know, this one, the place where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. But before we get into it, I gotta ask, James, how you doing?
Hey, you know what? I'm not diseased. I have scheduled my booster shot to get the new Omicron subvariant shot in a couple days. So I'm feeling cautiously optimistic. A very familiar feeling.
Well, why don't you ask Jeff how great having a booster shot like 5 days before he got COVID was?
Yeah. Well, he's got the bat. He's got the old booster shot, you know?
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, it's going out and buying like a pack of the previous set of Magic the Gathering. That's not really going to help you in modern format.
It is all I want to do, though, because all I play is Commander. Conundrum.
That's weird. All I want to do is have some fun.
Yeah, I'm actually feeling much better. I don't know if we've told people online yet, but I have a negative test, and I'm other than extraordinary amounts of fatigue, I'm primarily symptom-free.
As people may be able to hear, I still have, like, a stuffed-up nose, but I'm testing negative, so God bless.
Yeah, if I had to report one thing about COVID, beyond the untold horrors of the death it has caused over the past 3 years, it's that it creates a stuffed-up nose that Afrin cannot touch.
It is an untouchable nose.
It is. You can pour Afrin down your nose as much as you want, and it'll just come right in untouched into your mouth and do nothing.
Just get that neti pot of Afrin going. No problem.
Yeah. So anyway, it's good to be back, and I can't wait to actually have read one of these books.
Yeah, eventually.
That future. You know, you should read this book for the next one and just be one behind from now on.
Yeah, just, you know.
The rest of our career, I'll be one behind. It's a great idea.
We'll just start every episode from now on with a small retrospective on what we did from Jeff.
Last time on System Mastery.
Okay, so 2010, Powered by the Apocalypse comes out. If you have not seen any PBTA game stuff, Apocalypse World is
Well, I mean, it really filled a niche that the OGL left of use our game to make whatever. So instead of a flood of D20 nonsense, we have a flood of PBTA nonsense.
Mm.
And sure. I feel like it's interesting when you look at this, because you can definitely tell that this... It was like, oh, people really want to make a game, but by God, we have had enough D&D. And this being very much not D&D, I feel, worked so well in its favor.
Yeah. Yeah. I think just when we look at Apocalypse World, like, it is easy to start with in terms of design, because the mechanics are not that there aren't like a bunch of complicated, like, layered things that can, like, break when you put them against each other. Like, each move is its own isolated bit of design. So if you become familiar with the format to write a move, and the very book that you are reading, like, provides you the tools that you need to make your own custom moves, then you basically have everything you need to go nuts and make your own, you know, version of the game.
Well, yeah, given that the game only has five stats, each of them are going to have a -3 to a +3, though honestly, I don't think it, you have to, like, work to get to a -3. Like, you got to try to get there.
Yeah, yeah. A -2 is more than enough in Apocalypse World.
Yeah, and then the fact that it's 2d6 based as far as rolling, you generally, you know, if you've never played PBTA, the general idea is on a 6 or less when you roll plus whatever stat you're using, then you've missed. A 7 through 9 is a sort of okay success, and then a 10 plus is a solid success.
Yeah, I think what most systems would call a success, you really need to be rolling the best result to get in Powered by the Apocalypse. One of the interesting things about the whole, like, design node of it is when people who are not the Bakers introduce the idea of Apocalypse World and its mechanics, generally speaking, they start with, oh yeah, the core of Powered by the Apocalypse is the mixed success. It's, you know, succeeding, but other interesting things happening at the same time. I was really struck by how disinterested this book was in that mechanical innovation. You know, Baker really, really goes on to explain a lot of other things about the system, but kind of, like, just drops that and's like, this is self-evident. I don't need to explain this. Moving on to all my other ideas about vomiting forth Apocalypto.
Yeah, the 7 through 9 almost success is an interesting thing, especially because in this game, there are certain moves and roles that you'll do where 7 and 9, like in a lot of other games, they'll make it like, oh, this is success with a cost, or this is, you know, you can only choose partial success. There are still things in Apocalypse World where a 7 through 9 is like, no, this is fine.
Yeah.
It's not as good as a 10 plus, but you still do fine.
Yeah, yeah.
You'll have a nice meal.
And like, that's one of the things that I feel is lost in a lot of derivative Powered by the Apocalypse designs. I think people really latched on to the, like, success with a drawback being the result of, like, the mixed success thing. Because there are plenty of PBTA games where I will roll, you know, that 7 to 9 success and walk away with the feeling like, oh, I wish I hadn't rolled. This is worse than doing nothing.
Yeah, that is, and you definitely see that in a few of the roles in here. Like, it's not like it's missing from this. It just feels like that's less of a, like, design goal. Like you're saying, like, this isn't, oh yes, I wanted to make 7 to 9 be, you kind of get what you want, but I'm going to stick it to you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that shows up in a lot of other PBTA games, like you said, it just makes me look at things and go, God, unless I've got like a +3 to this, I do not even want to try. Because you're like, oh, 7 to 9, you succeed in doing a thing, but Satan rips your dick off. And you're like, oh, cool.
But
cool,
a dog cool. bites you in the dick.
That's trademark. You owe me $1.
It's okay. System Mastery will cover the licensing fees.
I can't imagine it. It's trademark, but this is System Mastery. It's got to be the one place where it's okay to say it, right?
Yeah, only I can say it, though.
Oh, but I say it all the time.
Yeah, but not on air.
He's been taking money out of your paycheck.
Fleecing me.
I'm constantly saying it off air, but that's just because dogs are constantly biting my dick.
It's true. It's fair use.
One thing that I want to add before we jump into this game, like just a little bit, I know this is not a show where research is very common, but I believe...
How dare you?
I believe these days the Bakers, Vincent and McGay Baker, talk about Apocalypse World as being more of a joint effort. First edition definitely just credits Vincent, but I believe like as time has gone on, they've been like, well, McGay was doing a lot of stuff in it too, and I believe second edition credits them both. So I want to, I guess, like put that up front for, you know, the big apocalypse heads out there who might wonder, like, well, why are we referencing Vincent Baker so much when McGay was involved in the design of the book? We're dealing with the past, you see, where the credits were different. And the other thing that I'll say is the Baker family is responsible for some of the most influential indie RPGs of the past several decades. They also did Dogs in the Vineyard and Firebrands. They've done some real bangers of games. They pretty much just designed the one and walk away, having done something like truly extraordinary that changed the industry. And then a bunch of like larger to medium sized companies will pick up their design and make millions of dollars selling games derived from them without putting a cent back upwind. So that's our brief history for this design like node and how Apocalypse World has evolved.
Good
man. Correct. I'm now looking at Vince Baker's like output list, and there are some stuff on here that I have to know more about.
Yeah.
Kill Puppies for Satan, Cockroach Souffle, the cheap and cheesy fantasy game. I gotta find out what these are.
Kill Puppies for Satan, like also kind of a landmark indie game. And I believe one that they're not the most proud of in retrospect, but, you know, it was fun.
You know, shit happens.
Yeah. If I was picking something here that I'm assuming they're ashamed of, it'd be the Seclusium of Orphone of the Three Visions. Because it's a Lamentations of the Flame Princess thing.
Probably.
Woof.
I'm surprised I even had to say that was Lamentation of the Flame Princess. Can you write stuff with those kind of titles?
All right. So, getting into the game...
Yeah.
As I mentioned, you have 5 stats, which are cool, which is your ability to, you know, be cool under pressure. Hard, which is, you know, how much of a badass you are. Hot, mm-hmm. which is how hot you are. Just big, sexy slab of apocalypse meat.
Mm-hmm.
Sharp, which is how smart and quick-witted you are, and weird, which is, you know, how weird you are.
Yeah.
All of the various playbooks in here, which are what PBTA games call classes, give you a choice of a set of stats. So instead of being like point buy or like, you know, rolling or doing anything like that, you get a choice of 4 different stat setups, and usually every playbook will have one of them that is their main stat, which will be a +2 no matter what, and then it'll kind of futz around with the other stats.
Yeah, it sort of like lets you decide what is important to you.
Yeah, now some will let you be like, oh, you know, there will be at least one loadout where if you're like, oh, I want to be... weird, even though that's not one of my main stats. It'll, you know, there's at least one setup where I'll get at least a plus one to it. Sometimes they're like, no, if you're whatever, you are not allowed to be like more than a zero in hot or something. So all just sort of depends on what you're playing and what the sets they give you to choose from are.
Yeah.
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 See?
Man, can, like Secret of the Ooze in here.
Since we're doing voices, I want to talk about how this book is written with a voice that is, I will describe as extremely pervasive throughout the book. there are sections like the first time this book introduces all of its character classes, which, you know, another thing that I have about this book is they introduce the character like playbooks at least three times throughout the book. The first time they do it, yes, it is entirely within the character voice of the narrator of the book, to the point where some of them I literally did not understand what the class was supposed to be because it was so deep in character.
I'm reading them right now because I had to get ready for the bonus content, and I'm sitting here staring at the opening paragraph for the angel, and the last sentence is like, okay, fine, you're the healer, but the up until the beginning of that, it's just a bunch of like insults to everybody but you.
Yes.
what is this, Vampire the Masquerade insulting everyone that isn't me? What the fuck?
You like the gods? The gods are gone. Your friends? They're all fuckers. Your mother, she sucks ass. And I'm like, okay, but what does this class do? Yeah. What is this playbook for?
and especially when you get to like some of the playbooks that are a little bit higher concept, it's just like, no, I really, really wish that you were just explaining to me what this is supposed to be instead of maintaining the voice of this book. And you know, to the book's credit, it's not all the time that I wish it would turn off the voice, but it is most of the time.
Basically, it just needs a little, all these descriptions are in italics, it just needs a little unitalicized at the section at the bottom that just says, you know, oh, by the way, this class is the getaway driver or something obvious, so you can kind of just move through it.
The thing is, it introduces every playbook three times. The first time, it's just the like in universe in character text. Then it introduces it again, includes that entire in universe text again, and then gives you the full breakdown of like, all right, what are your powers, what are your stats, what can you do, what are you? And then it introduces it again in the GM section, now with notes for why certain powers are the way they are, and includes again everything that was already included. So it just prints that same section of in-character text three times for no reason.
Yeah, like the thing that I was struck by when reading this is, man, this really could have used an editor. And not for the normal system mastery reasons that you want an RPG to have an editor where there are, you know, several page long run on cocaine sentences. Instead, it's like, well, you know, you are presenting like in-world sort of like thematic information and you've got game information, you're tying it together. And it's just like, well, you probably only need to give that to people once. You probably don't need to do it three times. And it, you know, it wasn't like there were even like too many divisions of like, oh, I'm anticipating that only GMs are reading this section of the book, so I'm dividing it up so GMs will only have to start here or something like that. It was just a decision that like only makes the book bigger. And I don't know, in 2010, especially when I have to imagine printing these books was not easy, why you would do that.
It's especially weird for me for the beginning only in character section, because it's just a few pages of here's the name of a playbook, here's a whole like in character text thing, and then immediately goes into, all right, well, now let's actually like, you know, tell you how to play the game and what the actual playbooks are. And I'm like, you didn't need this. I could have just flipped five pages, gotten to the playbooks, and been like, ah, okay.
Yeah.
Great. There it is.
Yeah, it's just like it's a strange choice that like I struggle to see what they were going for at the time. And I'm certain an editor could have looked at this and gone, Vince, you can actually cut some of this down. We only need you to do this once.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are even times in the book where they reprint stuff and they have like, oh, hey, we're reprinting this here in its entirety, even though we already printed it earlier. So you don't have to go flip back and look at it when we're talking about it. And part of me is like, I almost appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It makes me kind of want to look into whether or not the Baker family like runs a paper mill or something. And this is like a laundering project, like a make work thing.
I just read the description for the chopper, which I swear I got way more information about what they are and what they do from the list of recommended names. The beginning is just like a whole thing about how the world has lots of scarcity, and then it ends with, so, chopper, there you are. And I'm like, there you are what? Yeah, I guess you're just comfortable in scarcity? But no, they're the biker.
Yep.
You can tell when you look at the list of names, and it's like T-Bone and Dice, and you're like, oh, okay, they're bike guys. Got it.
Oh, chopper as in, like, motorcycle, not like I've got a cleaver or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's first what I was like, they must be axe guys.
I assumed it's like, oh, these are like scavengers who run a chop shop. And then like reading the playbook, it's like, you've got to manage your motorcycle gang. And I'm like, this is not congruent to what you wrote earlier.
What they wrote earlier has nothing to do with anything. It's just like, hey, all the things in the world ran out and except for bullets and gasoline. But everything else ran out. We're out of everything. So, chopper, there you are.
There you are, bud. With your motorcycle,
you
are.
You might mention this motorcycle. You might just say motorcycle at some point in the opening paragraph.
Never.
It's just a word that's missing. I guess it's in case they ride something else, like if they've got a tricycle or, I don't know, it's a recumbent bicycle gang.
This is my Vespa gang.
You might be doing a Mad Max, like, yeah, sure, we've all got, like, cars sort of thing.
Yeah.
Nope, this happened in Europe. So everybody's on like little street scooters. They're very gas efficient.
Hey, it makes sense.
Ciao.
It happens in Mos Eisley. It's the Book of Boba Fett gang.
Yeah, we got a swoop gang.
Those were not swoops. Those were mobility scooters of Star Wars.
Ah, yes, the hover round gang.
I don't know if you. My rascal.
I'm assuming you haven't watched Book of Boba Fett, John.
Of course not.
Star Wars sucks,
and I want nothing to do with it.
They're riding these little hover Vespas. They're adorable, and they're bright candy color.
Yeah,
which looks crazy driving around Mos Eisley, where everything is sand colored, and then around the horn comes four people on like candy chrome, pink, green, orange, and yellow bikes.
Oh, I've seen the bikes. It basically looks like they went ahead and made iMac bicycles.
Yeah, I personally loved it, but. Boy, it's a choice.
I mean, that show got so close to doing an office comedy about crime on Tatooine, and if it just like went a couple inches farther, it would have been incredible.
That would have been much better. Instead of all the kind of badass hard men stuff they kept trying to tell you it was about, if they'd been like, no, Boba Fett came up and he's just stymied by bureaucracy all the time.
Yeah. Two-thirds of that show is just Boba Fett trying to get a meeting.
Yeah.
You know what, fuck it, since we were talking a lot about them, let's get into the playbooks.
Yes,
I gotta say, as someone who has only really come to PBTA games through most of my stuff is like, oh, Masks and Monster Hearts and games where people were like, I've put a lot of thought into the meaning behind things and what moves are going to do during the game and how this will inform stuff. The playbooks in original Apocalypse World suck my ass.
That is a harsh way of putting it, but I will say, like, there is less sauce on these playbooks than most like modern Powered by the Apocalypse things, because, you know, they've developed the format. But Yeah, it does feel like the moves are a lot more generic. They move things less than some Powered by the Apocalypse systems that I would compare it to. There's just less spice here.
Yeah, most of the complaints I have are either the class, like the playbook itself, is either very boring or kind of, you know, stupid, or the moves themselves are like, oh, I don't care about any of these. These are just like bleh.
Yeah, I'm only looking at a few of them now, but I can see what you guys are talking about immediately. There's less extreme definition, which is kind of one of the fun things about PBTA playbooks. But then again, you know, this is the first one. They didn't figure that out quite yet.
So the first one is the Angel, which we mentioned is the healer. And, you know, I don't have a huge issue with the Angel. It's just sort of, you know, you're a medic. You get medic stuff. Your moves are like, you can have an infirmary or a healing touch or, you know, get armor if you're not fighting. So I was like, oh, that's all right. Sure.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward. The infirmary one definitely reads a little unusual, where I have no idea what it's even saying. It says you get an infirmary, a workplace with life support, I got those, a drug lab, and a crew of two, and then it recommends two, Shigusa and Mox, who I have to assume are characters mentioned previously. Get patients into it, and you can work on them like a savvy head on tech. And then in parentheses it says CF. I have no idea what we're talking about here.
So, the savvy head, being another playbook, has a move that is basically just you have a workshop. And so, for some reason, they decided to, in the one that comes earlier, go like, hey, you've got a workspace just like the savvy head does. Anyway, you're going to want to wait 20 pages before you figure out what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also note, in the savvy head description for workspace, it also is like, yeah, you've got some laborers like Karna and Twee and Pamming. And you're like, who, what the fuck are you talking about?
So those are just recommendations? The book have an established world that where Shigusa and Mox are people?
No. It does not. One of the things that I guess what we'll get to when we talk about the GMing, like I said, Visitbaker in this sort of dropped like the mechanical innovation of like the partial success without making much of a to-do about it. However, the GMing style, that is something that it's carried forward into other Powered by the Apocalypse games, is something that he really, really wants to drive home. And it becomes extremely evident in all of the choices that he makes throughout the book. One of the big things that he is a proponent of is like every person in the game who is referenced in the game, whether they're a PC or an NPC, needs to feel real and authentic in some way, which means everybody needs to have a name and kind of an identity associated with them. So in things where you get like characters who would be associated with your character, you know, workers, underlings, whatever, like he is also dropping like, oh yeah, like these names, like these strange names are now your thing. So that is got to be what I imagine they're trying to do and drive home in those descriptions there.
Yes, they don't want it to be like, you've got a couple people who help you out. Do not worry about them. They are literally just, you know, points on a character sheet. You know, like you say, there's a lot of GM section in this book, and a lot of it is like, make everything feel real. Make everything be like, even if you just introduce a person for one scene and they've got one line, that dude should have a name and something they want.
Yeah, that's fairly solid DM advice. I think that's great.
Yeah.
No, honestly, the DM advice in this book is the best thing about it.
It's, it is like truly revolutionary. And one of the fun things about it is it still stays in that character voice that the entire book is written in. But again, unlike the normal System Mastery experience, it's giving good advice instead of bad advice in that character voice, which is a charming departure for us. But going through the playbooks, I see next we have the Battle Babe. And in order to talk about the Battle Babe, I've got to talk about one of the other things that powered by the apocalypse, like some of the games maintained, but is kind of a hallmark of the system, is the sex moves or the intimacy moves that you might see in modern adaptations. Basically, one of the other things that, like, the assumptions that this game makes is these characters are going to have sex with each other a lot. And when they have sex, there are particular moves that, like, affect the mechanical things related to their relationship. And, like, lots of things can, you know, spiral around that. We recognize this a little bit from Masks and, like, the intimacy moves of, like, characters mm-hmm. going off and doing things, or in Monster Hearts, where when characters have sex, like, they go and do wild stuff. That, of course, started here. And the Battle Babe, which is a playbook that is like, you are a really tough, really hot person. That's kind of the whole playbook. You're not the toughest person in the world, but you're super tough. And you're not the hottest person in the world, but you're super hot. And my favorite thing about the Battle Babe is your sex move is that nobody's sex move works. Whenever they sleep with you, nobody's sex move does anything. So it is like,
it is one of the worst things.
Yeah. It's, all this interesting stuff is there and you just go, no, I just have,
especially because it's the second class. Like, you start with the angel and they're like, oh, if you have sex with the angel, then you have history with people. That's one of the stats that you have. So it's like, oh, you immediately know this person really well and they get to know you better. You know, sex with an angel is like, it's an actual intimate thing. One of the better sex moves that exists is the angel because it feels thematic. And then you get to the second one. They're like, oh, what's yours? Nothing happens. And at first I was like, that sucks ass that you're just like, what happens when you have sex with a battle babe? Nothing. My move is to nullify your move. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But then you read some of the other playbook's moves and you're like, oh, I'm gonna be the most chaste motherfucker, because like the driver has a sex move that is on a 10 plus nothing bad happens, and on anything else you get fucked.
Yeah.
You're like, well, I mean, it's a sex move. Why would I have sex then?
Well, I assume you're going to have sex with all the NPCs because they don't have the sex moves.
Oh, no.
No,
the sex moves happen.
Your sex move fucks you up. Yeah, the driver's sex move is if you have sex with someone, you roll plus cool. On a 10 plus, no big deal. Nothing happens. 7 and 9, they get a history with you, but you get minus one history with them.
That's very telling.
On a miss, you take a minus one ongoing until you prove it's not like they own you or anything.
Which I...
That's very telling of a design decision.
Well, and I actually love that. I love that so much because, like, that is kind of a fun thing, but the player isn't mechanically incentivized to do it. It is a mechanic that represents a particular dynamic, which is fun and cool, but it's like, well, if you're a player who's not familiar with this type of play, you're not, like, there's no carrot to drive you towards that. It's all stick.
Oh, yeah, the second one was like, ooh, I'm going to have sex with you. You're like, the fucking hell you are.
But like, if they were all carrots, then the game would be it would be a real problem, because you'd start every game, every new campaign, you'd be like, everyone fucks everyone else until we stop getting bonuses from it.
I mean, well, so, I don't have that much of a problem with that, because this is a game that, again, makes the assumption that everybody is going to be having sex with each other. So, like, and to the point where it's like, well, we've created a whole host of moves to facilitate action sprouted from that. Now, if each move kind of had something that is like, oh, there's a risk reward with this, like, sure, I am risking a bad result, but like, a fun and cool thing might also happen, but some of them are like, well, yeah, if you succeed, hey, nothing happens, way to go, champ. And if you even kind of don't succeed, then everything spirals out of control, it blows up in your face.
Yeah, because again, you have like some of the sex moves, like the brainer or savvy head or things like that, which are like, oh, if you have sex with someone, you basically get a read on them. So you can be like, oh, I can ask the MC some questions or figure out some stuff about whoever I just had sex with. You're like, cool, cool, all right, fine, great. You can do a move. You still have to roll for it, which means, again, you might fuck up the roll and screw things up. So you're like, oh, I have sex with someone and then blow their brain up. But with, God, that driver sex move just pisses me off so much.
Well, it's weird because it defines the whole character so strongly. It's pretty much a discouragement from having sex, where even at your very best, your very, very best option is nothing bad happens, which suggests that drivers are supposed to be fairly reserved about whether or not they're going to have a lot of sex during the game. But that feels like it's too character defining out the gate for, you know, if you want to play a driver that's just a total, just into sex constantly, then you probably don't want to play a driver.
Yeah. Especially because you look at things like, all right, you got the gun lugger who's just, I'm the big, ugly, like literally the best you can get as a gun lugger is a -1 hot. And that's one out of three of your options. The other three are all -2. You are just a ugly, nasty piece of shit, but your sex move is you take +1 forward and you can give your sex partner +1 forward too, which means everyone's like, yeah, but I want to bone down with a gun lugger. Yeah. I'm going to get +1 forward. It's so dumb.
So let me ask you, I know this is probably going beyond our usual territory here, but how do you fix this? Because putting in a mechanic for what happens when two players have sex with each other has historically been really hard to do.
Honestly, the Monster Hearts string...
Yeah, that's a good choice.
Is one of my favorite ways because it means both of you have this weird incentive but tension to it. So you're like, yeah, I'm going to be able to like get a string on this person. Also, my sex move is going to let me activate something else. But if I do it, they're going to have something to hold over me and they get to do a thing. So there's this weird like cost benefit analysis to having sex where you're like, I want to do it, but I also kind of don't want to. And as a game about like, you know, teenagers, that's kind of a great way to enforce that like teenage awkward sexuality of wanting to, but not really knowing what you're doing.
I'll say in here, there are some that we've even referenced, like really fun and cool sex moves. Like I truly love the one for the brainer, which we haven't mentioned yet, is like the psychic class where you're like kind of a little weirdo creep that's got like a veiled face and everything. But like when you have sex with somebody, you get to ask questions about them. They learn things about you, you learn things about them. That is, when we say these characters have sex, there is like actually an increase in intimacy because they learn things about each other. And that kind of happens regardless of whether or not the characters communicate or not. Like that is a really juicy narrative thing and kind of what I would want out of sex moves. And what I'm interested to see how this is approached in the second edition of this game. Like I'd kind of want all of them to be like, oh, there's reasons that I would want to do this, but reasons that I should be kind of cautious around it. Like ways that it could end up going really well and ways that it could blow up in my face, kind of like all the other moves in the game.
Or like actual sex. That'd be smart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, the brainer one, because you specifically have to, well, you don't have to, but you get to do the deep brain scan move, which is a brainer move, and you get to do it whether or not you took it as one of your moves or not. And you get to, you know, on a 10 plus, you get to ask 3 questions. 7 and 9, you get to ask 1. So you're like, oh, that's cool, you know, have sex with a psychic and they sort of get into your head a little bit. But as the psychic, you're like, yeah, but on a miss, I just inflict 1 harm on the person that I had sex with.
Yeah.
And especially for NPCs who basically die at 2 harm, you're like, ooh, if I fuck someone and get in their brain, I might fuck them to death.
You know, the other thing I really like, if I'm comparing this to Monster Hearts, like we were just a moment ago, Monster Hearts is a little more nebulous about what defines sex. It's a little open to interpretation of what constitutes when you would need to roll your sex move. I had always thought that was the case here as well. that mostly it just refers to any kind of night of intimacy or something. But no, this book straight up says, like, anytime your character has sex, then you do the following thing, which I get. But again, it feels like it kind of defines what the game expects from you more than it's just saying, like, when you have an intimate moment or something, which is what I was used to from things like Masks.
Well, yeah, and, like, that's the innovated version of it, right? That is someone taking a look at this and going, like, you know, we can consider this more broadly, and it's a very cool thing, but we don't need to marry ourselves to sex. But, like, in this game is really pushing for something that's quite different, you know, especially like when you consider the indie designed landscape around 2010, like it does look different. There is a lot less explicit mention of intimacy and sexuality in role playing games. So I can see why it drove so hard to, you know, push people in that direction, because, you know, you can say a lot of things about this game, but this game is very clear about what it wants to be and how it wants people to approach it.
Yeah, the whole, like, you know, this is a game about, you know, hard fucking, hard fighting, hard scrabble people in the post-apocalypse, and, you know, everyone's just trying to find some sort of comfort. And I get the whole, like, yeah, I want to have sex moves. And I was like, all right, I understand that. I really wish they were better across the board. Like, not just that you got better bonuses, but just that they were better implemented across the board.
Yeah, and I think that is really derivative of, again, the other thing that this book is really trying to drive home, the play to find out philosophy, where you as a player and, you know, especially as the master of ceremonies, as this book calls it, GM, they are trying to push you in the direction of, like, well, you're doing things to do them. You're not really doing things because they'd be mechanically advantageous or whatnot. And so, like, yeah, a lot of the results of the things that you could do are overwhelmingly negative, but you're doing it because you want to do it, not because you are trying to succeed at something, which is interesting. And I think there are parts of the book where it's very successful in creating a mechanical foundation for that, and parts of the book where it's like there could be more work here to actually make this idea come to life and really sail.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they have a mechanic that is the want mechanic of, like, oh, if something goes wrong or you fuck up a roll or just, you know, anything's going on with your town, there are things where they might get wants. So it's like, oh, the town has the want disease. They're diseased. They need medicine. So, you know, your hand might be forced to be like, all right, you've got to go scavenge out getting some drugs or whatever. And so there's ways that the game can push you to be like, yeah, you might not, like, mechanically want to go do this because it would be a bad idea, but we're also mechanically making it so that you should go do that. Your character wants to go do that. Yeah. So you should go do it. That's good. I like that. It's neat. And it's weird because that want mechanic comes up the most in some of the playbooks I like the least, which is the pet class playbooks. Because the chopper gets a whole biker gang, and that is your only move. You're like, what do you get? You have a gang. What else? Fuck you. You have a gang.
I gave you a gang already.
You have the hard holder who's just like, I'm in charge of a city, like a settlement. And like, okay, cool. Are you gonna go on adventures? I don't know. I'm like the mayor of town. Probably not.
I run Barter Town. Figure it out.
Well, you've already mentioned at least two others that that get like a permanent station that they live around. Between the angel being able to have and the savvy head both having like bases of operations. So it seems like you could potentially play this game as more like defense of the small apocalypse town you live in
versus
constantly wandering the wastes.
I think that is generally the assumption that they make, is that everybody is kind of grounded and bound around a single location. Because one of the assumptions that you're supposed to make is that everybody knows each other, whether or not they like each other. They know each other and they're more or less on the same side, even assuming some tensions or whatnot. So, like, yeah, they give you these things that are grounded in one location because they're kind of assuming that you're going to be playing that way.
You know, unless you're the chopper and you're like, oh, I'm a biker gang and we're specifically mobile. I got the mobile tag for them so that they aren't, you know, confined to one area. And also, I'm the driver. The whole point of me is to drive around and go places. And then if you get those two and someone's like, and I'm a hard holder and I'm the mayor of this town, everyone's like, oh, God damn it.
Well, I guess, is there anything stopping you from defining your town as like a bunch of RVs? So you can be like, yeah, my character is a doctor and owns a medical facility, but it's a trailer and it's being pulled by a truck.
I mean, because it's powered by the apocalypse, not really, because, you know, there's...
It's pretty open.
Yeah, it's pretty open, but I don't think there were any specific things like that for Hardholder. I guess to avoid people making complaints to us, I'll also say there is the Hocus, which is like you kind of have a cult. So that's another.
Yeah,
like,
you're the cult leader.
A bunch of pets for you.
It is the other pet class. It's one of the ones where I went like, God, if you run a game and you're like, all right, we got three players. We got the Chopper, the Hardholder, and the Hocus. And oh, God, I'm going to need to have names for like 50 fucking people.
Yeah. And names and personalities. You got to make it real. You got to make it real.
You got to do it. The Hocus has 20 followers. The Hardholder has a whole goddamn town. And then, of course, the Chopper has an entire gang. And you're like, oh, no, please, no, please stop.
All right. This is Pikachu. This is Machamp. Yeah.
This is Hingus.
At least
this
the game built around it. Yeah, I mean, at least the game's, like, built around it. Because one of the problems you run into sometimes with, like, D&D games in particular is people. You have that one player that, like, is just naturally a pet collector and just wants to have, every time they find a monster, like, I want to train it. At least this game, yeah, if you're supposed to have all those. So that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. It is creating room for them, and it is, like, representing a particular kind of thing. I do think it foists a lot of work onto the GM. And another thing that I've kind of found with, like, especially Powered by the Apocalypse games that have a pet collecting element is because you are likely to fuck up rolls, your grip on the one thing that you can do is pretty tenuous, actually. Where, you know, a gunlugger or battle babe, like, yeah, they can get hurt or whatever, but, like, they're pretty much always going to be able to do the point of their class. Things can spiral out of control for the Hocus pretty quick, and it's like, well, your cult is gone, and you are a cult leader, so I guess that's that for you.
I mean, the fucking Chopper is like, ah, you've got a gang. Also, on a miss, they fucking overthrow you and you're gone.
Yeah.
You're like, I'm sorry. What?
For a single move, but that's it.
You're like, oh, well, you fucked up. You rolled bad, and now they decide that you suck, and now Vinny's in charge.
God. We've got the operator, who is like, this one was the hardest.
Gig economy, the playbook?
Yeah, it was the hardest to understand. You're like a little bit a con person, but you're also just working three jobs.
Yeah, it is 100% I'm on Fiverr, the playbook.
Which was a kind of super fun. Not a thing that I think I've seen in a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction, so it was unexpected. But yeah, a fun idea. And then we've got the Skinner, the sexy sex haver that has sex, but it's a little creepy because this is the apocalypse.
Well, yeah, the Skinner is the one who's like, ooh, I bring beauty to the world because I can dance or sing or paint or something. It's like, I'm the artist, but also mostly it's just that I'm sexy.
Yeah.
So there are two playbooks in this game that are primarily defined by how sexy you are.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It's okay. I'm sexy and social, or I'm sexy and violent.
Yeah. Because I just finished reading The Battle Babe a second ago, and wow.
I honestly love the Battle Babe. I can't help but think of the Resident Evil movies. It is kind of perfectly encapsulating what that is for Alice. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I love the Battle Babe because it is not gender locked. You can be a dude Battle Babe. Mm-hmm.
That is completely true.
And two, one of their moves is just, if you're naked or nearly naked, you have two armor. And I'm like, fuck yeah, I want to make a dude with a huge gun, Porky Pig in it for two armor at all times.
Please, everyone
just
knows.
Hanging this. Brain for two armor. I the gotta do it.
The apocalypse works on Burning Man rules, and if you're out there shirt cocking, people are gonna get real mad at you.
Yeah, well, they can be mad at me. I've got a gun.
You've got. Yeah.
I was like, what I meant by wow when I was talking about the Battle Babe was the description of them is written entirely from the perspective of why other people shouldn't mess with them.
Yes.
So all it is like, hey, if you see a Battle Babe, you should walk away, but you can't. They're so sexy. And when you fall in love with them, it's like a zillion volts and your wings burn off. And you're like, well, okay, but what do they do? Like, do you want me to associate that with, like, I don't know, Molly or Sally Shears from Neuromancer or something where, like, sexy, dangerous, Razor Girl assassin? Or is it just literally that they're so hot that you die?
Yes.
Yes. Kind of want to talk about the other overwhelming mechanic in this that I actually did not associate with Powered by the Apocalypse, which is clocks. This, as far as I can tell, is where the clock mechanic originates.
Yeah, honestly, going through this, one, I did not realize that sex moves were in the base game Powered by the Apocalypse thing. And I also didn't realize that they had countdown clocks as a main thing. I was like, oh shit, look at you, Blades in the Dark, stealing shit from here. All right.
Yeah. Now, this might be a factor of both Vincent and John Harper were like active on the Forge forum, and that clocks might be something that spawned out of there. But as the Forge forum is something that had a community that was so toxic, it burned itself down and is completely permanently deleted forever. There's no way of knowing unless you were one of the people who was there. So as far as I could tell, this is where clocks live.
Yeah, it's you've got your harm clock as a player. So, you know, as you get more harm done on your clock, the later sections of the clock get like smaller slices to get more granular, but the first ones are like big old chunks out of it. And the first two harm you can take, you can just sort of heal yourself. After that, you got to get healed. And if you get to midnight, then you are out, but you can be revived. If you go past that harm wise, you are full dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And gosh, this game had a lot of recommendations on how to use these countdown clocks, like dividing up, like during different sections, maybe introduce this role here. Like one of my favorites was like they were talking about a plague and how like a community can be facing a plague. And like the first few sections are like you're trying to stave off having an outbreak. And then like the final quarter is like really segmented and you're like trying to prevent that outbreak from progressing. And then they provided an example of a clock that's like, OK, well, let's say you're infected at these stages, you're trying to roll out of it to do this. And if you get to your last few segments, like you have these options. And it was just a really fascinating way to show off how to dynamically pace something using this mechanic that like I am really surprised that we didn't see clocks take off until Blades in the Dark, because this book uses it really effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's got it for battle moves, it's got it for hit points, it's got it for, like, narrative things, and I think the big thing, though, is it doesn't really push the clock as a huge thing. Like, it feels like, here's this innovative thing we've done, but it doesn't seem to, like, really push the idea that this is a thing you are going to be using for everything, because it only comes up for like, oh, this is hit points, and here are some optional ways you can use the clock for stuff. instead of it being like the main thing, like in Blades in the Dark.
This game is so blasé about a lot of its mechanical innovations, like, because it's kind of blasé about sex moves too. Definitely like an underwhelming like a feature for the partial success. But what it really cares about is moves. It really, really wants people to understand moves and takes the time to explain moves and how they work multiple times from multiple different angles throughout the book.
Yeah, one of the weird things for me in PBTA, and which is a thing in this book, but I feel like helps describe a little better, is especially the GM moves, where I'm like, I don't know why you're calling this a move. This is basically me just moving the narrative forward. But they're like, oh, yeah, you can do a move where you, like, do harm to someone or make things worse or an explosion happens or whatever. I'm like, that's not really a move. That's just me saying you did a thing and fucked up and now there's a tire fire.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that has always been the thing about the GM side of Powered by the Apocalypse stuff is, like, it is trying to provide a bulleted list of options of how to move the plot forward, because it's like, okay, the player misses. And if you are, I guess, a GM who really has no idea what to do, you can consult your GM moves and go, okay, I just have to do one of these things in response. Like, it's a neat way to teach the style of GMing that Powered by the Apocalypse wants you to use. But I personally, like, it's not a thing that I would invest too much in, but the system is really proud of it, really excited about it, and really especially on enforcing it on the player's side. Like, there is a lot of, like, hey, if somebody is doing something, they are either doing it through the move or it's not happening. And in order to activate a move, they need to be describing something that is triggering that move. And there is a lot of narration that is working very hard to drive home those points.
I loved that part of this where they're like, it works on both sides. If someone just says, I'm going to go aggro, they're like, okay, that's great. What are you actually doing, though? Like, don't just tell me you're doing a move. Tell me what you're doing. And then from the other side, if someone's like, yeah, and then I get in this dude's face and I'm like, fuck you, man. And then he goes, cool, so you're going aggro? Like, are you gonna roll for that or no?
Yeah.
And that whole, like, you need to have this full integration where it's not just, I want you to narrate things or I want you to roll things. It's, I need you to be really interacting with all of the bits and pieces together.
Yeah.
So does this game have the same mechanic that has moved forward in other PBTA games where players generally don't pick their moves? They just say what they're doing, and then the MC tells them what to roll?
No. This one much more was like, if you want to say, hey, I'm going to go ahead and do like a, like try to seduce or manipulate someone or read a situation or whatever, you can say that, but then you really have to say, okay, but how are you doing that? Why is this the move that you are going to be doing? Like, how does that read into it? So there is a little bit more of, like, I do like that for players who are like, oh, I came to this from, you know, D&D or something super crunchy, where I just say, like, all right, well, I'm going to do a power swing. And you're like, okay, cool. What does a power swing look like?
Yeah.
So you can get into this where it's like, I'd like to, I don't know, go aggro. They're like, all right, what does that look like? How do you make them be afraid of you or do what you want?
Yeah. And since we're talking about moves, I suppose we should go down the list of moves that are in the game, because that is the other big component to Powered by the Apocalypse after your playbook. We've got Act Under Fire, which is, you know, doing something in a dangerous situation where you're likely to get hurt.
Mostly a thing that the like MC will force on you. They're like, oh, you wanted to do a move? Well, you're currently, like, your car is spinning out or someone is literally shooting at you, so roll to do it under fire to see if you actually can.
Then we've got Go Aggro, which is kind of like acting aggressively in social situations. Like, you're not fighting so much, but you are getting a little physical and being kind of a dick. And I absolutely love that there is a move for this.
Yeah, it is the way to be like, oh, I want someone to, like, back off or do what I tell them or tell me something. It's like what would normally just be an intimidate role somewhere else is now go aggro, but it lets you have a selection of weird things you can do.
Well, it's like more than that too, because like if you were to describe your character like shoulder checking someone as you walk through a threshold, that's technically a trigger for go aggro, which I love. It's just like, hey, if you're gonna be a weird dick about things, we've got a move for that, and wild shit can happen as a result. There is seize by force, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's grabbing something through force, taking control of like an object or person or whatever. There's acting with violence, which is, you know, attacking someone. There is seduce or manipulate, which is, again, exactly what it sounds like, trying to manipulate somebody or be sexy with them. There's read a sitch. Which is read a situation for those who aren't really up to date on slang in 2010, haven't watched their Kim Possible in long enough, which, you know, that
oh,
is...
I thought it was Sietch from Dune.
Ah, yes. examining a situation. There's read a person, which is a separate thing. So rather than, you know, taking stock of an environment, it's looking at an individual. And
open your brain, yes, to the world's psychic maelstrom.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I've seen that in multiple playbooks, that there's all these options to open your brain to the world's psychic maelstrom. Do they go into greater detail about what the world's psychic maelstrom is?
I have great news. No. They do not. In fact, there's a point in the book where it's like, hey, we've talked a lot about the world's psychic maelstrom. What do we mean by that? We don't know. You can figure that out. Fucking
yeah,
great.
There's a point at least where in the GM section he's like, oh, in one of my games, the world psychic maelstrom was literally all about love. And so anytime you tapped into it, it was about like the feelings of love in the world. So when you tap into it, I would have people get like weird relationship stuff, or, you know, it would change their outlook. And I went, oh, that's neat. So they're just like, there's a psychic maelstrom. It is whatever the fuck, who cares?
Yeah,
all right, well, I'm glad they set their rules for it, at least to let you know that no, we don't know either, but it's got to be something because so many moves rely on it.
Yeah, which I think is a cool thing. I think that is a cool blank space, but it is wild how much it shows up without there being any real definition for it. Finally, help or interfere, I think, is the last one, which is
the fact
plus
that
the
there
session
is
ender.
An interfere with move that you can use on other players is such a dick thing.
God, especially in this game, where you can lose your entire character class from one roll.
Because, like, the whole thing is, in PBTA games, including this one, I'm sure, is only players roll moves.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So when you choose to interfere someone else's roll, that is, you're guaranteeing that's a PvP action.
Yep.
All right.
It is so, and it's worse than helping, because if you help, they get plus one. If you interfere, they get minus two. But if you roll a 7 and 9, then you expose yourself to danger by doing it. So if you want to interfere with someone, you're like, yeah, but I might 7 and 9 and fuck myself in the process.
I mean, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, it says on a 7 through 9, you also expose yourself to fire, danger, retribution, or cost. And I got to say, as a player, if you interfere with me, I don't care if you roll a 7 through 9. You just opened yourself up to retribution.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny to think that if you roll a 10, you just don't.
It doesn't say what happens on a miss, which.
Yeah. That seems to be common in here.
Yes.
Come on.
That is a pretty common thing for Powered by the Apocalypse things, and it baffles me. I think the assumption is that the GM is supposed to make a GM move, which are listed in the GM section.
Right. Yeah. We encountered that when we were reading the Kingdom Hearts inspired one as well, that it just constantly forgot to say what happens on a miss. But there was a DM move section. It was just very generic. It wasn't very interesting or thematic.
Yeah. One of the interesting things with this is we hadn't mentioned yet, but I was just looking at it because of the session end. Everyone, when you are making a character and you go around the table, you have a history stat with people.
HX!
And your HX, history, extreme.
Glad to learn what that means.
So you get your Baja Blast history mm-hmm. with people. Yeah. And
your gamer fuel history.
So it's one of the couple of ways that you can get experience is the better you know someone, you can get up to... history plus three or history minus three. If you ever drop down to minus four or plus four, you reset to either the negative or the positive one, whichever direction you are, and then get experience. But so, history is basically what you're rolling if you are trying to do something, usually for a player. Like a lot of times you'll substitute history where if you were like, oh, I'm trying to go aggro on an NPC, I would roll hard. But you might use plus history with a player because you're like, oh, I know this person and I know how to be a dick to them in order to get them to do what I want.
So the fact that history is resettable, that whenever it goes above or below three, it turns into a zero again and you mark experience, suggests that it's not really your established long-term history with someone, but more like your current status with them.
Kind of. Because when it does a reset, there is like a transformation in the relationship. So, you know, it's like history through this particular mode of our relationship. Like, you know, you might go from frenemies to bitter enemies or lovers or whatever on, you know, a positive or negative reset.
Okay, that makes sense enough. I was hearing that I saw it was a history mechanic. It was eternally cycling. I was like, they probably should have called that standing. But I get where it's coming from then.
Yeah. Yeah. I think standing.
The whole thing is supposed to be how well you know the other person and how well they know you. So the fact that it cycles, you know, kind of is like, oh, I know you as well as I'm going to in this way, and now I have to find a new way to get to know you.
Well, yeah, it's like, you know, knowing somebody very well as a friend, and then you start dating them, and it's like, well, how well do you know them in a relationship type? Like, I get what they are going for. I think it actually works quite well, and it's an interesting mechanic.
Yeah, I mean, you always have to have one of those. There's one of those in every PBTA game. The sort of how are you connected to the other people in the party mechanic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in this one, instead of it just being like, oh, tell me what this person did in your past, it's like, no, tell me what they did, and that's an actual mechanical thing. So everyone goes around and has to be like, all right, I gotta name someone that once, like, helped me out of a bind or whatever, and they'll get bonus history, and it's interesting. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Other than that, you know, the game has gear. Normally, it's just a set of, like, tags on a thing. So it'll be like, oh, this does 2 harm at close range and is loud and messy. And the money system in this is just barter. You have, like, oh, I've got 3 barter worth of shit. You can go ahead and define what that means if you want to, but mostly it's just like, oh, I can go trade some stuff. I've got stuff that is tradable.
Yeah, I thought that was a neat mechanic, that there's a whole bunch of... I found it interesting that it seems like each playbook includes its own cost breakdown for what barter does for them. Either that or I just read The Angel and it had all that cost mechanic stuff, and then they just assumed that going forward.
No, it's reprinted on all of them.
Yeah, each playbook has it. Which, again, I think it is a cool mechanic. I don't know of a lot of Powered by the Apocalypse systems that had much of a stuff economy to them. Like, even Dungeon Worlds was, like, pretty underwhelming. So it was cool to see one that, like, seemed very functional and, like, I think it would be fun to engage with in this game, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I can see why they aren't usually there. The mechanics are already all... they're all just narrative tools as opposed to, you know, mechanically breaking down the actions of a fight. So knowing what a sword's stats are generally aren't that important when you're more having a story fight than an actual fight.
Sure.
Yeah, the big thing with barter is... because you can be like, all right, I have three barter, and there's a very clear idea of like, this is what one barter means. If the MC ever goes like, okay, you know, you fucked up a roll or some shit goes wrong, like a rival gang comes and is way huger than yours and goes like, you need to give us two barter in order for us to leave you alone, you can very clearly go, shit, that's like a 2/3 of my stuff, man.
Yeah.
And because barter is also not a thing that's, for most people, something you can just be like, oh, I just, you know, I'll go out into the waste and scavenge and get some barter. Like, the operator is one of the ones who are like, no, that's like my whole deal, is I have jobs to generate money. Like, that's why you play me, is because I have multiple jobs.
Yeah.
So, I do like that barter is a thing that the GM can use to kind of, like, hang over your head and be like, look, you've only got one barter, which is, like, a week's worth of staying in a place, so sometime in the next week, you gotta find more barter or you are fucked.
Yeah, yeah. It's a cool leverage point. It's a cool leverage point for different players to access, too. I just think it's neat, and it's something that I would appreciate seeing in other Powered by the Apocalypse things. I guess where it's relevant, because, like, you don't need it in Masks.
Yeah. No, there are definitely certain games where it would work better than others.
I would love to see a giant gear list in, like, Monster Hearts. That'd be great.
Yes.
I mean, it'd all be stuff like, you know, cool backpacks and chokers and things, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you could just be like, what do you have? I've got one barter, but this is barter for, like,
high
the
school.
Teen world, so I've got, like, a pack of cigarettes and a porn mag or some what, shit.
One barter is a week's worth of eyeliner for your vampire, so you gotta find it.
I have the answers to next week's history final in a folder.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on to our leasts and mosts favorites for this game. Jeff, should I even ask you, since you haven't read this?
Nope. No, I'm abstaining.
Great. Moving on.
Yeah.
James, what would you say is your favorite thing in the Apocalypse World First Edition?
I am going to say, like, there's a lot to like here, but probably the GM advice, I think, is one of the things that, like, kept this book around and so influential for as long as it was. Like, there are a lot of cool mechanical innovations here, but this explains a style of play really well, and that got carried forward in every iteration of a Powered by the Apocalypse thing, like, down the line. And it taught the world this extremely fun play style, and it did it very mm-hmm. clearly with a lot of cool examples.
Yeah, yeah, I think 100%. There's a reason we've mostly left Vincent Baker and Mekwe Baker alone until this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, their legacy is really good, and it stands on its own. Like, it's kind of hard to scratch some of that stuff, but it is a delight to know that, like, well, even in this landmark book, you are contending with this author voice.
Now, there might also be the fact that I have consistently throughout my life confused Vincent and Keith Baker, my Eberron boy.
So if your name is Baker, you're probably pretty good.
You're one of them fabulous Baker boys.
I like all of these Bakers, so that's why we rarely talk about their stuff.
They call them the Bakers
and the candlestick makers. Fuckers.
There are 11 other undiscovered, not 11 other, there are 10 other undiscovered games Bakers. When they hit, it's going to be big.
When the 13 are aligned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't worry. They got those games in the oven right now. Yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, the best thing in this is the DM advice. Like, you're right. A lot of the ways in which the game really presses you to be like, make this very player-facing and try to obfuscate the rules whatever you can. Try to make it feel like this is happening just from choices and the actions they took are going to flow naturally into things. Don't say, like, oh, as a GM, I'm going to make things bad for you as a move. You're like, no, just, you know, say what happens. Try and make everything feel very cohesive. The DM advice in this is fucking great. It just is.
Yeah.
But what's the worst thing in first edition Apocalypse World?
There's stuff in here that we haven't touched that does not age super great. Part of the like harm mechanics are like permanent things that you can accept instead of dying. But they're phrased in ways like, well, if you get disfigured, it permanently lowers your hot. And if you get crippled, it permanently lowers your hard. And it's like, yeah, this was 2010. And also, this is clearly a thing that is going for a particular kind of like edgy voice. It's not wonderful to look at. I'm certain that things are different in second edition, though I cannot confirm that. It's just, yeah, did not age super great amongst a bunch of other stuff that is actually pretty cool and good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, you'd expect this that puts this into a small club of games that don't seem to recognize that beauty is inherently subjective.
Yeah.
Because, no, believe me, you can go on Twitter for like 3 minutes and find people that are insane for eye patches.
Yeah, it's a weird stand for this game to make, you know, especially when you've got a bunch of little weirdos running around.
Yeah.
Well, especially when you're like, man, the whole point of this is that everyone's like, I'm from the fucking post-apocalypse. I'm probably fucked up in some weird way.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. It's the fucking apocalypse that everyone's going to be have a bunch of scars and so on. That's just part of it. And it worries me that would reasonably define that the Battle Babe and what was the one that was the other sexy
Skinner?
One?
The
Skinner. Thank you. That they're like unmarred.
Example Skinner picture has a scar over their eye. It's it's a weird thing. I know what they're trying to do.
It's a sexy one.
The idea that you are like, okay, instead of dying, I'm going to take a permanent stat penalty. Like, that's fine. It's just the way they phrased it, which is not fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that. And of course, I will take one of these.
My least favorite thing, of course, is goddamn, those sex moves fucking suck ass.
That's fair.
Like 90% of them. God, that fucking the Battle Babe one of just you don't get your move and that's my move.
I
fuck you.
Absolutely love that. I have to disagree because I just love that you can play the Battle Babe and be the biggest no consequences slut in the apocalypse. That's great.
I'm gonna take one because of the 20 pages I've read, just tell me what the fucking playbooks do. Don't give me this poetry shit. that's all.
All right. Let's go ahead and see. Hey Jeff, would you play Powered by the Apocalypse, first edition Apocalypse World Apocalypse?
Okay, well, there is a second edition that I assume fixes a lot of the minor things that we've already complained about. That said,
I didn't ask that.
I know. It's a preface to my game. I was going to say, that said, yeah, probably. This seems like it's a lot of fun.
Awesome. James!
Yeah, I'd play this. I would definitely want to play the second edition of this, but yes, I would even play the first edition for sure.
I see you're afraid to yell at James.
Me! Yes, I would also play this.
Mention the second edition.
Mention it.
No, fuck you. There's only one edition.
Oh, yeah, let's get some edition war stuff around this.
I'm getting into that APOC World Edition War, baby.
Oh, God, I wonder if I can find that. I want to scour the internet.
There's got to be some chode.
Yeah.
There's always some chode.
Well, if you're scouring the internet, you're definitely going to find some chode.
All right. There we go. Fuck yeah. Thank you, James, for joining us. Is there anything you would like to plug before we get the fuck out of here?
Hey, check out Campaign Skyjacks on your favorite podcast app for a cool actual play. And look at the shelves of your friendly local book or game stores for the Ultimate RPG Guide series. If you're going out to get the recipe books that Jeff and John put out, you might find my books right next to them and accidentally buy them at the same time. That would help me a lot.
Heck, if you're looking at the if you're looking at the Ultimate RPG series, you might accidentally buy our book.
Very true. Oops. Very true. You fucked up.
Yeah, don't. We, they didn't give us royalties, no.
Awesome. So check out some Skyjacks, check out some books, check out our books, check out our Patreon, patreon.com/systemmastery. We are going to go make some characters in Apocalypse World. Even Jeff is going to join us for that, too. He's going to make a character even though he doesn't understand anything, which means it's going to be exactly like a normal episode.
Dick.
That's what happens when you let me be in charge. So head on over to patreon.com/systemmastery. It's the very bottom bargain basement $1 level. We make characters in the games we review. There's a ton of characters in there, a ton of goof-em-ups and fun ideas for things you can play. We are going to go do that. And of course, you can also get the other levels, which will give you our expounded universe bonus content where we go to Wikipedia and look stuff up, and our afterthought and our TV mastery at the top tier at the $5 level, and also gives you a bunch of Discord privileges and other dumb nonsense, and it's great and we love it. And then you can ask us questions and we'll be like, yeah, I don't know. So join us, won't you?
That's worth your money. I don't know.
Thank you for coming along on this apocalyptic journey. We will see you in a couple weeks with some more System Mastery. And until then, all of you, have a good one.